While the human cost of conflict in Iraq continues to rise and rise, Canadian journalist Adani Dittmar has been reckoning the cultural cost to the country following the US-led invasion in 2003. Adani Dittmar spoke to the 11th Hour recently about her continuing research in Iraq following the publication of her book Dancing in the No-Fly Zone last year. She began by reading an excerpt from the book.
This is an excerpt from the chapter called Karim, about Karim Wasfi, who had been one of the principal cellists in the Baghdad Philharmonic, who the last I heard had taken work as a mercenary. And I'm describing my meeting with him in pre-invasion Iraq. Karim was part Circassian and part Turkish. His mother had been Egyptian and his father a famous Iraqi actor. More than 6 feet tall and at least 250 pounds, he was not someone to take lightly in any sense. When he played the cello, his huge frame wrapped around its shape and they fused into a giant being of sound. That sound had occupied such a huge space, reverberating in his apartment and then in my memory. It was such a contrast to the gloomy press center that sometimes it was hard to believe that the soaring spirit of Karim's cello and the depressing pettiness of Ba'athist apparatchik bureaucracy occupied the same country. But they did, and that was part of the attraction, what kept me coming back for more, how to bleed that unexpected greatness, that astonishing depth of meaning out of concrete walls of suffering, out of days spent with stone-faced minders. Somehow I always managed. Indeed, that's how I'd first met Karim. One evening after a thunderstorm, during my 2000 visit, exhausted by 2 weeks detailing the excesses of brutalist Iraqi architecture, I'd wandered accidentally into the Al-Rashid Theater. I was feeling dead inside, crushed by the weight of the regime and the heat of the long day, and I walked into a room full of the most beautiful music. It was the orchestra playing Heartbeat of Baghdad, a symphonic poem by a young Iraqi composer. My affair with the city was rekindled. I'd stayed in touch with Karim by telephone and email. On February 17, 2001, the day after Baghdad had been bombed by U.S. warplanes, he'd phoned me to wish me a happy birthday, not even mentioning the bombing until I brought it up. He'd been performing Beethoven's Sonata in G minor in the garden of the Orfali Cultural Center when guided missiles lit up the night sky. He'd paused for a moment, he told me, and then calmly said to the audience, "Go if you must, but I'm staying. I came here to play music." Almost everyone remained seated until he'd finished his performance.
And that was Adani Dittmar reading from her book, Dancing in the No-Fly Zone. When we spoke to Adani recently on the 11th Hour, I began by asking her when she first went to Iraq.
I first went in 1997, Porak, for the New York Times, and I was on assignment initially for the magazine to do a story on a day in the life of an Iraqi hospital as a way into telling the larger story of the humanitarian crisis that was unfolding because of the sanctions. Then I stayed for 5 weeks and ended up filing stories for the daily paper. It was, you know, at the time the big news story was the weapons inspectors and the cat and mouse game that was being played between Saddam and the UN. But what really kept me interested in the story was the story, as it were, you know, beyond those headlines, which were just interesting for maybe a couple of days, really. But the incredible culture and resilience and hospitality of the Iraqi people was what really hooked me on Iraq, and I tried as much as possible to evade my cagey minders from the Ministry of Information and say, well, I'm going to the market, or I'm going for lunch, and or I'm going to the theater, and I would find these ways to escape their grasp and get out on my own as much as possible and talk to real people.
When did you come into contact with the culture of Baghdad and the culture of the Iraqi nation?
Well, actually, there's an Irish angle to this, because it was that same trip in 1997 when the weapons inspections were big in the news, and there was this kind of surprise journalistic field trip to the palaces. If you remember, at the time, there was this big issue about access to the palaces, and somehow, because the phone line at the Al-Rashid Hotel in my room wasn't working, I missed the call from the press center, which was at 7 a.m. or something. So I went to the press center at 9, and everyone had already gone, and I was very disappointed that I couldn't get into the palaces. And a young fellow who worked there, who turned out to be the nephew of Tariq Aziz, who was a Christian, and also a student of English literature, said he would take me to the Friday market to, you know, do a sort of story on the market. And I thought, God, you know, I'd rather be in the palaces doing that story. But in fact, we had this really extraordinary afternoon walking around, talking to women that were selling cardamom and spices and going through neighborhoods with kind of ruined villas and incredible senses of history. And this young literature student wanted to discuss literature with me, wanted to talk about Najib Mahfouz and Samuel Beckett. Beckett being really huge in Iraq at the time. I guess Theater of the Absurd plays well in police states. So I felt suddenly that, you know, the only way I could really capture Iraqi reality was by writing a book, and that was sort of my first inspiration for writing the book. But so the culture kind of got inside me, so to speak, through everyday connections with Iraqis, but also through my discovery of the Iraqi theater scene, which was thriving under sanctions in Saddam, largely because under sanctions, along with spare parts and penicillin and lead pencils and science textbooks, for some reason, you know, film processing chemicals were labeled dual use. In other words, they could conceivably be used for military purposes, I suppose. So all the cinemas closed down and reopened as theaters, the idea being that you only need sort of human passion and ideas to create good theater. So often there would be plays going on, you know, in the midst of power cuts, and they would be acting by candlelight on stage. But there was just this incredible sense of resisting the hardship and the difficulty through culture and through kind of a sense of cultural defiance.
And was the tone of this theater similar to, say, to the music hall theater of London during the Blitz, or was it political in nature?
There was certainly kind of, perhaps a similarity with that kind of theater during the Blitz, or also as one actor mentions to me, and as I relate in my book, it was like the Depression era in North America, when there was a lot of singing and dancing musical comedies, because people needed to forget their troubles. So there was a huge popularity in terms of musical comedy, but it wasn't like your average musical comedy, because of course people were living in a police state. So the theater became a way and a means through double entendres and, you know, the layered meanings that you can use language that way, you know, to criticize the regime. It was sort of similar to what theater was like in Czechoslovakia and Václav Havel, and, you know, so the playwrights were really pushing the envelope politically, where the state-run press dared not tread, you know. Of course, you know, the real sort of dissident poets and artists, many of them had been communists who were purged, so to speak, in the early 70s when Saddam was the head of the secret police and when the CIA conveniently gave him the names of all the communists. So one of the many bizarre scenarios in post-invasion Iraq was that the CPA, the Coalition Provision Authority, actually brought back a lot of these communists who had fled in the early 70s and in the 60s before that even, many of whom were playwrights.
Perhaps the cultural story we're most familiar with over here after the 2003 invasion is the destruction of the National Museum. Can you tell us what was in that museum before it was looted?
Well, the destruction of the National Museum, of course, was a huge tragedy for Iraq, but also just for civilization. But I think you have to look at a couple of things there. I mean, one is that the looting of Iraqi artifacts had been going on, in fact, during the 12 years of draconian sanctions, because the country was broke, the dinar was devalued by 3,000%, and civil servants who worked at museums and at heritage sites would often be forced to sell things to feed their families. And there was a huge network of smugglers operating inside and outside of Iraq. And, you know, so stuff was being looted and ending up in Geneva collections, private collections, etc., well before the invasion, largely as a result of the sanctions and the sort of slow deterioration of the state that way. But, of course, that was the most dramatic image of the destruction of Iraqi culture. And I think that all the Sumerian and Babylonian treasures that were looted, of course, that represents a huge loss to Iraq and, as I said, to the world. But in a sense, the destruction of the museum was really symbolic for the larger destruction of Iraqi culture and society. I mean, we're looking at a place that lived through the Iran-Iraq War, 12 years of sanctions, and then the invasion and the occupation, and has, in fact, you know, lived through various invasions by foreign nomadic hordes, as they say, you know, down through the ages. But at least, even at the height of sanctions in Saddam, when things were very difficult, there was still a secular culture. There was theater, there was music, there was the Baghdad Philharmonic, there were 100 art galleries in Baghdad alone. And now, really thanks to the combination of de facto theocracy and criminal anarchy that has emerged post-invasion, there is a kind of virtual death of culture.
You use the model of the orchestra as a way of describing what has happened to art and culture in Iraq. The orchestra was founded in 1920, isn't that correct?
Yes, it's one of the oldest in the Middle East. That's right, yes.
And what were the conditions? Was the musicians played in the 1920s? How did that differ in Saddam, and how is it now under the Americans?
Well, the story of the orchestra is kind of a sad story, because one of the characters in my book, Karim, who was the principal cellist in the Baghdad Philharmonic and has now since gone on to sort of find work essentially as a mercenary, his story is very poignant. But the larger story of the orchestra is that under sanctions, when I met with the conductor and went to some of the rehearsals, people were working three or four different jobs just to make ends meet. The biggest struggle was just getting everyone to show up for rehearsal. But at the same time, the music took on such a vital importance for people spiritually and psychologically that a lot of the musicians and composers I spoke to said, "Look, if I didn't have this, I'd die. You know, I just, this is the my lifeline." So there was this sense of sort of playing for time almost, and a kind of a passion and a desperation in the music. But, you know, people couldn't get orchestral scores under sanctions. They couldn't get CDs. They couldn't get strings for their violins. They couldn't get reeds for their oboes.
But so, essentially they were playing a Western repertoire, were they not?
Yes, it was Western symphonic music, but the thing that drew me in was really this incredible sense of Iraqi-ness and passion. And one night I was having a very difficult assignment in Iraq, and had a nasty minder from the Ministry of Information. I was just about to sort of throw up my hands, and I went for a walk, and it started raining, and I ran into this theater that was close to my hotel, and turned out to be the Al-Rashid Theater, which has since been bombed and looted. And the Al-Rashid Theater was home to the Iraqi orchestra, and I heard this beautiful music, and I didn't know the orchestra was rehearsing that night, but I just was drawn to this music, and it sounded like Western symphonic music, and yet it felt very Iraqi. And I listened to it and spoke to the young composer afterwards, who had written what was in fact a symphonic poem called The Heartbeat of Baghdad. And he was a young 26-year-old composer who'd never left Iraq, because he'd come of age knowing only war and sanctions and was sort of trapped there in a sense. But he created this wonderful piece, which was really a tribute to his city and to the history of Baghdad. So, you know, other scores that I heard were, for instance, one that was entitled To the UN, which was this angry anthem, essentially a protest against what the sanctions regime was doing to ordinary Iraqis while it was in fact entrenching Saddam's power. And it was kind of like Iraqi Shostakovich, if you can imagine that, but it was so powerful. And I know we have a wonderful orchestra in Vancouver, but the Vancouver Symphony Orchestra, a lot of Western symphonies, you know, they've sort of lost that desperate passion that maybe was present in earlier forms of symphonic music, but in Iraq it was just so alive, that expression.
You mentioned that the orchestra are going to tour America next year with support from the American-backed Ministry of Culture. How did they feel about that?
Oh, well, actually, just to bring you up to date, the orchestra, I mean, you know, they suffered under sanctions. They couldn't get strings, they couldn't get music, etc. The Americans came, and their fortunes fared slightly better, because I think their salaries were doubled and they were able to get some reeds and strings and things that weren't available before, and a couple of U.S. soldiers joined their ranks. But it was more ominous post-invasion, because they had to play under armed guard because of threats from Islamic militias, essentially, which was never the case before. And there was a kind of cynical manipulation on the part of the CPA with the orchestra, because they wanted to sort of, in essence, use them as a symbol of the new Iraq, when in fact their, you know, U.S. policies had, under sanctions, had made things very difficult for the orchestra. And there was talk of a U.S. tour, but that was in the immediate aftermath of the invasion in 2003 and early 2004. Now, as far as I know, the orchestra is doing no more performance. No one is really doing public performance in Baghdad now because it's just too dangerous. And there is, as I said, a de facto theocracy that's been created from this once secular and very westernized culture. Now, because of Islamic militias, some of whom are being funded and armed directly or indirectly via the U.S., there is really no more cultural life in that sense. So it's very much kind of underground, people maybe just playing for each other in their homes, or, you know, the poets and writers that I've been talking to say that, of course, they do this very clandestinely as well.
You mentioned that you're familiar with Beirut and that the culture and art there had recovered somewhat in the most recent episode there. Have you any optimism that things will get better in Iraq?
No, I'm not optimistic at all. I think that Iraq has been deliberately targeted and its civil society has been systematically destroyed, not only during the recent invasion and continuing occupation, but we have to look at the damage that was done during the eight-year Iran-Iraq war and more pointedly during the 12 years of sanctions. There was economic collapse, there was a breakdown in public health and education. You know, we're talking about a country that had previously the best health and education in the Middle East. We're talking about a country where the status of women had been one of the highest in the Middle East, where before the first Gulf War, half the civil service and almost half of the doctors in Iraq were women. And now we're talking about a place where, thanks to the American-backed constitution, Sharia law has been enshrined in what had been one of the most liberal constitutions in terms of family law in the Arab world. So I think that because of these deliberate policies of destruction of the civil society, you know, when you smash a state, there are consequences, and we're seeing those consequences unfolding now. I don't know how many years it might take for Iraq to recover, but the one thing that does give me hope is the Ruhe Iraqiye, the soul of the place, and the kindness and the generosity and the resilience and the spirit of the people and the artists that I've met and been documenting for the last 7 years.
And that was Canadian journalist Adani Dittmar talking to me recently on the 11th Hour. Dancing in the No-Fly Zone by Adani Dittmar is published by Aris Books.